blunt words from President Biden. He said Vladimir Putin cannot remain in power. According to this career diplomat,
he said, I think what millions around the world, hundreds of millions around the world believe, actually millions of Russians also believe.
But what did Biden mean? Also today on the show, Shanghai is heading back into COVID lockdown. It took people by surprise. Panic buying is now set in. Chinese rappers are capturing the madness of the moment. And across South Asia, the caste system has long been used to marginalize people. It's also made its way to American universities.
I wasn't invited to study sessions or lunches or hangouts.
Exported discrimination. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. This weekend, President Biden delivered a fiery speech in Poland talking about the situation in Ukraine. But it was one ad-libbed line about Russian President Vladimir Putin that caught everyone's attention.
For God's sake, this man cannot remain power.
Officials with the Biden administration have been walking back the remarks ever since. But those nine words have thrown politicians and diplomats across the globe into a bit of a panic. Here to talk about the ripple effects and the path forward for diplomacy is former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. Ambassador, does Biden's remark change the diplomatic push to end the war in Ukraine?
No, I don't think so at all. I don't think it changes the actual substance of the war, tragically. Maybe he shouldn't have said it or not. That's, you know, we can debate that. But he said, I think what millions around the world, hundreds of millions around the world believe, actually, millions of Russians also believe. He didn't call for regime change. He said Mr. Putin shouldn't be in power. But that won't change if there's ever in a moment for negotiations to negotiate with Mr. Putin. And ultimately, remember, that negotiation will be between Putin and Zelensky, not Putin and Biden.
So if Biden said something that a lot of people believe, but, you know, the world can't really act on per se, let's look at diplomacy. What is the biggest weakness in the West diplomacy towards Russia at the moment?
You know, wars end in two ways, generally. Either one side wins or there's a stalemate on the battlefield. Right now, neither of those two conditions are true. Mr. Putin, for all of the troubles he's had and for all of the heroic fighting that the Ukrainian soldiers have done, is still making advances. And therefore, the West, in order to help diplomacy, needs to help President Zelensky produce stalemate on the battlefield.
What do you make of news reports from the Kremlin that one option may be for Russia to divide Ukraine if it turns into just a long war, kind of a la the Korean Peninsula?
Well, Ukraine's already divided before this war. Remember, Crimea was annexed. Donbass was de facto already under control of Russia. What I do see in the military strategy is Mr. Putin trying to unite Crimea with Donbass, and in particular, you know, the battle for Mariupol, which, you know, one of Zelensky's aides called their Stalingrad, is where he's focused his forces right now because he wants to divide Ukraine before he sits down at the negotiating table. And I fear Mariupol will fall, and I fear that will put them in a stronger position when they finally seek to negotiate. But let's be clear. President Zelensky has made it crystal clear. He's willing to talk about almost everything, including neutrality for Ukraine. But he is not willing to talk about changing of borders through the use of force. That is going to be a big sticking point if they ever get to a point where Zelensky and Putin sit down face to face to try to end this war.
I wonder, though, if Zelensky is losing leverage every day that the Russian military kind of brute forces its way deeper into Ukraine.
Absolutely. That's exactly the way he feels. Every day that they lose ground makes it harder to negotiate terms of peace that are acceptable to the Ukrainian people. And that's why every day he asks for more weapons and more sanctions from the West.
Yeah. So what else should the West do and how fast should they be doing it?
Well, with respect to sanctions, more sanctions every week. It's not enough to sustain sanctions, as some people say. It is my view, and it's President Zelensky's view, that there should be more sanctions every single week, including a focus right now on trying to put new sanctions on oil and gas exports to Europe. And then second, more weapons. President Zelensky said that they need more weapons. They need airplanes, they need tanks, they need anti-aircraft weapons, surface-to-air missiles. They're fighting a formidable army, and they have fought heroically, but now they need more supplies to continue that fight.
Who or what is holding the West back from more sanctions or more pressure?
Well, with respect to sanctions, there's a divide within the West. Germany, for one, does not want to cut off its energy imports from Russia. They think it'll hurt their economy, and they're right about that, by the way. I think that's a legitimate concern. With respect to weapons, different countries have different views of that, including the United States. As we learned, the United States did not want to send the MiG-29s, the aircraft fighter jets that Poland allegedly was ready to give to Ukraine. And President Zelensky's expressed his frustration over that.
If you had your way, Ambassador, would those MiGs in Poland be in the skies of Ukraine right now?
I think we should listen to President Zelensky when he says what he needs and not second guess him, not believe that we know what are in his military interests better than him. And if I were working in the Biden administration, yes, I would be leaning in to try to give him the weapons that he needs to stop Putin's advancing army. Because if he doesn't stop the Russian army from advancing, there will not be the conditions for a peaceful settlement.
So the last time you came on the show, Ambassador, you recounted an anecdote from your negotiations with Russia over Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. It was around 2014, in the last days of your tenure as ambassador. Let's hear that.
And a very senior Russian official said to me, he said, Mike, remember two things. One, we care more about Ukraine than you do. And two, you guys have short memories. We don't. So we're going to care more, and then you're going to forget about this part of the world.
I mean, the Russian official was suggesting that the U.S. would eventually turn its attention elsewhere, but Russia would remain focused on Ukraine. Do you think that's still basically the case this time?
Well, a lot, yes and no. In the long run, of course, Ukraine matters to Russia more than it does to Americans. It's on their border. It will be. They have a long history. And by the way, that long history is one that both President Zelensky and Mr. Putin have acknowledged. They just talk about it in very different terms. But I do think President Biden's trip was important so that we don't forget about Ukraine.
So, Ambassador, news is coming in today from the investigative group Bellingcat that three members of the delegation between Ukraine and Russia on the night of the 3rd to 4th of March experienced symptoms consistent with poisoning with chemical weapons. One of the victims reportedly was Russian entrepreneur Roman Abramovich. So as we watch what Russia is doing in Ukraine, how much does the world also have to watch what the Kremlin is doing outside of Ukraine?
Well, again, if those reports are confirmed, it underscores how evil Mr. Putin is. I mean, let's just call it for what it is. And I think that should underscore the point that President Biden was trying to make in Warsaw. It is a fight between good and evil.
Michael McFaul was the U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 14. He currently directs Stanford University's Spogli Institute for International Studies. Ambassador, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
China's largest city, Shanghai, is going under a COVID lockdown in two phases, a staggered closure intended to allow the country's financial center to remain partially operational. But the last-minute announcement is also sending residents scrambling for supplies. The World's Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai and joins me now. How serious is the situation in Shanghai right now with COVID?
Well, Shanghai is this sprawling international city of 26 million people. But yesterday, the city recorded 50 symptomatic cases and 3,450 asymptomatic cases. And that's more than half of the nation's total asymptomatic cases. So they're setting up gymnasiums and an exhibition hall to house all these patients. They have not wanted to do this kind of large-scale lockdown that we've seen other cities do, like Xi'an and Wuhan. So for the past 2 weeks, we've been experiencing this kind of rolling lockdowns affecting different housing communities. It's very confusing because people all over the city are in different situations. So some people are hanging out at bars and eating at restaurants, while other people are just stuck inside for days on end. But in the end, they announced what's going to be China's largest lockdown. So the stock exchange is going to remain open, the port and the airports are going to remain open, but factories are closed and all public transportation is suspended.
Mm. Responding to 50 symptomatic cases, I mean, those numbers are seemingly low, Rebecca. But in the end, as you say, they announced what's going to be China's largest lockdown. How did people in Shanghai hear about the lockdown?
Well, it was kind of sprung on us because even just last week, the city government was publicly refuting rumors of a citywide lockdown. But at 8:30 last night, the announcement went out. It's going to be this phased lockdown. So first one side of the Huangpu River that divides Shanghai, and then the other side. So everyone's social media started lighting up with videos and memes of panic buying. People were sharing videos of overflowing shopping carts and people emptying store shelves. So this video of a fight breaking out over vegetables got a lot of attention. And on WeChat, China's messaging app, this rap song went viral just overnight. It's called Panic Buy. The lyrics are all in local Shanghainese dialect. It's all about the craziness of trying to buy groceries during this time.
Panic Buy. So how are you coping, Rebecca? How's everyone taking this in?
Well, I feel lucky because I live on the side of the river that has till Friday to get groceries. So even though today I went shopping and I found lines outside of the wet markets and most sellers were already sold out. And I spoke with shopkeepers. They said they've been experiencing supply chain issues for the last week because wholesale markets have been closed down. But I'm the lucky one. On the other side of the river, people were caught mostly unaware. They had to just run out with just a few hours to prepare for this several day lockdown. But also there were people all over the city who were already in lockdown because they had a positive case near their home. I spoke to Karina Feldman. She's a single mom from Brazil who's lived in Shanghai for 16 years. She's on her 23rd day of being stuck inside her 12th floor apartment. Yeah, no end in sight. She has a son with ADHD, and she says it's been a real challenge to manage his schooling while working as a teacher herself.
It's very difficult to keep sanity. But I have to because of him.
Was she whispering there intentionally, Rebecca?
She said, it's very difficult to keep sanity, but I have to because of him. So she's whispering there because she's just trying so desperately to hold it together for her son, who's just in the next room. She told me she's depending on delivery workers to deliver groceries, but she has to wait for days on end, and the deliveries are often canceled like minutes before she's expecting them. So these supply chain and logistics issues are having a real impact on people's lives.
Yeah, on her and her son. How long is this lockdown going to last, Rebecca?
Well, the official word is that one side of the river will do from today till Friday, and the other side, where I live, from Friday until Tuesday. But we've been seeing over and over, things will just change on a dime. So I don't want to make any predictions because the last time I spoke with you, I was in the middle of a 48-hour lockdown, and it actually was 6 days before they opened the gates. So we don't really know when this is going to end. The health officials are saying we can't stop until every single transmission is stopped. And Xi Jinping wants to win the fight, you know, over COVID by the time he secures another term as leader in October. But this new strain of COVID just seems uncontainable. So this is a whole new challenge for health officials here.
The World's Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai with the latest on the continuing COVID lockdowns there, the biggest city in China. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Still ahead this hour, the new order in the Middle East. Top-ranking diplomats from the Arab world come to Israel to chart a path forward, sending a signal of unity to Iran. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. El Salvador is under a state of emergency. The government declared it after a terrifying outburst of gang-related killings this weekend. The decree makes it easier for President Nayib Bukele's government to make arrests and suspend constitutional rights. For more on this, we have The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, on the line. Jorge, can you explain what led authorities in El Salvador to impose a state of emergency, and what does it mean now that they have this power?
Yeah, Marco, this was a horrific weekend for El Salvador. It's a small country of only about 6.5 million people, and it saw more than six dozen murders this weekend. The government quickly pointed the finger at organized crime, at the country's notorious gangs, and by Sunday morning, the government had declared a state of emergency. It allows, among other things, President Nayib Bukele's government to wiretap people's conversations and to detain people for up to 2 weeks without any charges. This is a measure that lasts for 30 days, and it can be extended.
So scores of people killed in one weekend, gang violence, it's really shocking. What do we know about the victims? Like, who was murdered and why?
It seems almost random when you look at the people who were killed. I mean, we're talking about a farm worker, a construction worker, a baker who was delivering bread. If there's anything that is really apparent here is that there is no obvious connection between the people who were killed and the gang members who are suspected of having murdered them.
So now constitutional and human rights at stake with the state of emergency following the violence. Has anything like this ever happened before in El Salvador?
Well, we should be very clear that this is the highest number of homicides that the country has seen in a single weekend in decades. But there have been similar spikes in recent years. There is a widespread belief that President Bukele made a deal with gang leaders about 2 years ago to get them to basically reduce crime. Now, the president has denied this, but this was reported thoroughly by the investigative news outlet El Faro and has been verified by the U.S. government. And it appears that somehow something changed with this deal recently. I spoke about it with Celia Medrano, who is a human rights and public safety researcher in San Salvador.
Realmente cada tres o cuatro meses hay un repunte, lo que deja demostrado que realmente son grupos de criminalidad organizada.
Medrano is saying that El Salvador has seen these kind of spikes every 3 or 4 months, which to her and to many people indicates that really it is gangs who have the key. They are the ones who are in control and that they are using murders to send a message to the country and to the president that they are the ones who decide when and how many El Salvadorians are murdered.
Wow, that really suggests things are unstable in El Salvador, especially with this new state of emergency now. So what does that mean for average Salvadorians going about their lives?
Well, this is a grim reality, Marco. A former president 10 years ago made a deal with gang leaders to get them to stop killing each other, basically, and it worked briefly. Now, Nayib Bukele these days is a very popular president. His approval rating is of more than 70%. And probably the biggest reason why he's so popular is because he has been able to bring down violence. But it's hard to see how he can continue to be a popular president if the country continues to see violence like the one that El Salvadorians saw this weekend.
Jorge Valencia, the world's Latin America correspondent, thank you very much for the latest.
You're welcome, Marco.
In Hinduism, caste is the ranking of a person's social status handed down at birth. It was outlawed decades ago across South Asia, but that doesn't mean the discriminatory practice has gone away. In fact, it's found its way to the U.S. and onto American college campuses. GBH's Kirk Carapeza says there's now a growing movement among universities to ban caste-based discrimination.
When she was studying psychology at California State Sacramento, Manpreet says she was shunned by other Indians because of her low caste.
I do have like light skin privilege and people just assume that I am dominant caste, which probably has worked in my favor. But, you know, people catch on really quick.
On campus, Manpreet used a fake name because her last name would reveal her caste. But when her classmates learned she worshipped with Dalits or untouchables, they shut her out.
And eventually, like, I wasn't really part of their group. Like, you know, I wasn't invited to study sessions or lunches or hangouts, and I felt very isolated.
Manpreet's experience on campus is not unusual. She asked us to use only her first name because she's been threatened for speaking out. Low-caste students from India report bullying and verbal and physical assault. A survey by Equality Labs, a South Asian human rights group, found one-third of Dalit students in the U.S. reported experiencing caste discrimination. It's much worse in India. That's because those considered untouchables face a lifetime of discrimination. The jobs they can hold, who they can marry, and often the schools they can attend are all dictated by caste.
My South Asian colleagues tried to silence me when they heard my experience.
Prem Pariya is from Nepal. He says his caste followed him all the way to Cal State, and so did the discrimination.
I had fear of when I reveal my identity, I could use the dominant caste surname, but I thought this is not the solution. I need to speak up. I need to educate people about this caste discrimination.
Earlier this year, the entire Cal State system, with nearly 500,000 students across 23 campuses, added CAST to its non-discrimination policy. It follows Brandeis University in 2019, then UC Davis, Colby, and Harvard. And advocates predict more colleges will soon adopt similar policies. But there are Indian Americans who deny that caste-based discrimination exists here in the U.S.
I know as a second-generation Hindu American that I was not aware of my caste until my ninth grade teacher in world history asked me about it.
Suhag Shukla is executive director of the Hindu American Foundation. She would not self-identify her caste, telling me my question was, quote, deeply offensive. Shukla opposes what colleges are doing.
Caste is not the central way of identifying that these policies are presuming. They're essentially institutionalizing a false stereotype about Indian Americans.
And she says neither Cal State nor Brandeis has reported a single complaint about caste bias.
Some of the examples that I've read are, well, someone looked at me up and down.
It's not in everybody's interest to move to a post-caste society.
Rajesh Sampath teaches courses on global ethics and human rights at Brandeis, and his ancestors come from a low caste. He says many so-called enlightened Indians say caste, just like race, is a non-issue.
If we can't see it, it doesn't exist. They take the good parts of what they bring to the United States and maybe repress or exclude the other side, the darker side of a narrative.
For Cal State graduate Manpreet, caste is very real. Now out in the working world, she says she's faced caste discrimination on the job. And she says banning caste bias on campus is just the beginning.
This isn't really getting at the root of, you know, how do we actually abolish caste and create an environment that is safe and supportive of Dalit students.
She says there will only be real change when other Hindus see people from lower castes as equals. For The World, Kirk Carapeza, Boston.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. In a small forest in Colombia, what was once a barren landscape where cows used to graze is now lush with towering trees and dense vegetation. The secret?
El abono orgánico de escarabajos es un producto único en el mundo y es importante.
Organic beetle fertilizer that's unique in the world. How one beetle farmer in Colombia is building an environmentally friendly fertilizer industry from insect poop. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Many families with very young children are in a tricky spot right now. COVID vaccines still are not available for kids under age 5 here in the U.S. This may soon change. Moderna and Pfizer have announced they are pursuing approvals this spring. But outside the U.S., in places like Chile, thousands of children as young as age 3 have already been immunized. The World's Alana Gordon explains what's behind the different approaches.
Like many parents, Shirley Monsalve Gonzalez has really wanted an effective vaccine for her 4-year-old son.
Hola, ¿cómo se llama?
Él es Pedro, mi hijo, di hola.
When I ask him his name directly, he gives me the universal response of children. A mouth fart. Gonzalez is a pediatric urologist in Chile, in the coastal city of Viña del Mar. When the pandemic hit, she joined her hospital's COVID response team.
Vi paciente muy grave.
I saw very serious patients, very seriously ill, she says. I thought at some point this was going to happen to children. She was worried about bringing COVID back to her family. I felt some fear, she says. In general, kids just haven't gotten as sick from COVID as adults. But little ones may suffer from a rare inflammatory syndrome. There are concerns about long COVID or future variants. Pediatric hospitalizations have gone up with Omicron. When Gonzalez learned her son would be eligible for a Sinovac vaccine as part of a trial late last year, she enrolled him.
Pedro, mi hijo, se vacunó en noviembre.
He got his first shot in November. A few weeks later, the former president of Chile, Sebastián Piñera, stood sandwiched between children holding balloons and announced that vaccines would be available to all kids, 3 and up.
Estamos muy contentos porque lo que más...
We are very happy, he said, because what parents want the most is that their children have a life and can be happy.
Y puedan ser felices.
Thousands of young kids in Chile have since gotten at least one shot in the two-shot series. The Sinovac vaccine, developed in China, uses a similar platform to lots of other vaccines for kids, like the flu. And for that reason, Chileans have really embraced it. Chile's public health agencies recently found it may not protect a lot against infections, but it appears to do a good job at preventing serious hospitalizations.
There's still a lot to be learned. That's my view about it. I feel also very humbled.
Alexis Kalergis is a professor of immunology at the Catholic University of Chile. He has been heading the big trials of vaccines in little kids in the country. He says the most important thing is they found the vaccines are safe.
Data from the studies from the Ministry of Health, some of it with Omicron and the biggest one with Delta, are, you know, suggesting that the vaccine not only safe and immunogenic, but also is efficacious, is effective.
In the U.S., it's been a messy path towards approval. Pfizer recently regrouped to study the effectiveness of a three-dose series. Dr. Paul Offit heads the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and is a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee.
Showing that you have the right dose and the right dosing interval and the right number of doses. That's really the hardest part. And it's hard because there's always sort of an arbitrary bracket of children's ages.
With COVID, kids just aren't getting as sick, so it's harder to tell if the vaccines are working. Offit cautions the full data on the trials in little kids around the world hasn't been reviewed yet. Donna Farber is a professor of immunology at Columbia University.
What we're finding out is we need to understand more about children's immune system and how it's different than adults.
Kids tend to get more sick from most viruses. Farber has some ideas about why the opposite may be happening with COVID.
Kids might be better adapted and they have more of the sort of immune arsenal they need to respond to a new pathogen compared to an adult, and definitely compared to like an older person.
In general, kids respond much better to vaccines. They're able to build up a long-term memory. We get most shots before starting elementary school. With COVID vaccines, the response in kids hasn't been so clear. Arbor says it's worth looking beyond the mRNA ones that have been considered the gold standard for adults to more traditional approaches.
So we know that these types of formulations are really effective in children. So it could be that for whatever reasons, maybe it might be a good idea to consider going forward other vaccine formulations in young children.
In Chile, Shirley Monsalve Gonzalez is aware of the complicated science and politics at play. But she says, if for my son, the only option I have at this moment is this vaccine, I prefer that over no vaccine. In January, she and her whole family got COVID. Symptoms were really light. She says she can't know for sure, but she'd like to think the vaccine protected them. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
A quick note that tomorrow, Alana will be leading an online discussion with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. With the war in Ukraine, the frame of public health also has to include basic humanitarian needs. Ukraine is struggling with basic health care, also a lack of food and public services like water, electricity, and heat, not to mention the psychological trauma from the war. All of this threatens the lives of millions of Ukrainians. Ilana's guest for this live online forum is Michael Van Royen, director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. Check out the live stream tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. It'll be on our Facebook page and on our website, theworld.org. Ilana is already fielding your questions about Ukraine's humanitarian needs. Email them ahead of time to myworld@theworld.org and then join us online tomorrow at noon Eastern for that live discussion. Today, foreign ministers from four Arab League nations met with Israeli and American officials in Israel. Another breakthrough is how Israeli officials described the meeting with Bahrain, Egypt, Morocco, and the UAE. Palestinian leaders saw things differently. With us to talk about this is Hussein Ibish. He's the senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. So, first of all, Hussein, can you tell us the motive behind these talks in Israel?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea really is for all the countries that really think this process is working for them to try to give it more of a structure and essentially create a set of inducements that could get others like Saudi Arabia and others to join. So it's got a dual purpose. One is to strengthen the kind of multilateral angle here, because there's been a lot of progress, especially between Israel and the UAE bilaterally. But by bringing in the Americans and the Egyptians, as well as the Israelis, the Bahrainis, and the Emiratis, they're grasping towards a regional security factor that these agreements could possibly open up.
So we saw a group photo of the players at this summit, Secretary of State Antony Blinken holding hands with his diplomatic partners. It seemed very jovial. What is the headline from today?
Well, I mean, I think the headline really is that this is going to be an ongoing set of meetings, that the meeting took place in Israel and that it's going to take place again. And so I think that's sort of the point. If this were just a one-off, it really wouldn't make that much of a difference. It wouldn't be that significant here. So it is an effort to really to look beyond, you know, sort of an American-dominated region for stability, but to have a Middle East that remains stable, but that stability is more guided by a network of regional alliances, including the American presence.
So Israel is saying that it has formed an alliance that will help deter Iran. I mean, is this the new alliance, Bahrain, Egypt, Morocco, and the United Arab Emirates?
It's an axis. And even if this were to be the nucleus of something else, that's all it would be a nucleus. What you're looking at, though, is an effort to bolster kind of the multilateral angle here. And especially, I think, is ultimately an effort to create the groundwork to get more countries to join. So what I think you're looking at is an effort to create a stronger axis of pro-American states that oppose Iran's hegemony and that see each other as partners. And it's really about that. I think it's about strengthening security ties.
So Palestinians and the Palestinian Authority were not part of the talks, and they see things differently from countries like Egypt and Morocco. Why do you think they view this summit with suspicion?
Well, because it doesn't do anything to advance their interests in terms of liberation from occupation, in terms of freedom, human rights, statehood, independence, anything like that. And to the contrary, they may see it as another blow. Because every time Israel gains a major diplomatic chit in the Middle East without doing anything to address the Palestinian issue, this is seen by Palestinians as a net loss of leverage that they might have had or did have the day before, but now today they don't have anymore. And I actually think this is a very debatable way of looking at things, because it's really questionable the extent to which they had anything say last year or the year before that they don't have now.
Well, the idea of a two-state solution slips further and further away in the rear view, but it's not dead. And with Egypt at the top of the list, along with to a lesser degree with these other Arab states that are in Israel today, they continue to see it as a path. Could the summit give the two-state solution some kind of life?
I don't think so. And I think it's noteworthy that Jordan did not participate, right? The one Arab country that has got diplomatic relations with Israel, and that in some ways has the most mature relationship with Israel, going back a long way, did not participate. But they also feel threatened by the idea that the occupation and even eventually annexation could somehow become acceptable in the region, and that's very threatening to Jordan in the long run. So I think both the Palestinians and the Jordanians see the problems for them with going forward with these kind of major new ties to Israel without doing anything to address the question of the occupation or, as you say, a two-state solution, which remains theoretically available, but it looks increasingly onerous as something to aspire to. It looks like a very, very heavy lift indeed. There are other ways, of course. I think that it's increasingly clear there may have to be some kind of a novel sui generis solution to a sui generis problem between Israel and the Palestinians.
Hussein Ibish is the senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute, speaking with us from Washington. Hussein, thank you very much.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
Someone named Marcos could again become president of the Philippines. The latest polls show Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr., son of the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos, far ahead of his closest opponent in the lead-up to the May 9th election. His running mate, Sara Duterte, is the daughter of the current president. Support for Bongbong, also known as BBM, has been bolstered by a surprising voting bloc, young people. As Ashley Westerman reports from Manila, these young voters are being targeted with some revisionist history.
If you're on TikTok in the Philippines, you've likely seen a pro-BBM video, or two, or 20, or 100. This must be love. This song is often used in videos featuring young, attractive people dancing as the words "Who's your president?" and hashtag BBM for 2022 president flash on the screen. Then there are the videos that feature inspiring audio coupled with pumped up music, kind of like a hype video.
We will always carry the flame that will burn until Marcos's return.
Experts say these kinds of videos are part of a campaign by the Marcoses and their supporters to normalize and even glorify the family, essentially paving over a dark period in Philippine history, when the dictator Ferdinand Marcos, BBM's father, ruled the country with an iron fist from 1965 to 1986, 10 of those years under martial law.
There was a lot of corruption, human rights abuses, and atrocities committed under his term.
That's Gemo Fernandez, a Philippine lawyer who's written about the family's attempt to rebrand its image. Marcos was known for jailing and torturing dissidents, silencing journalists, and running the economy into the ground. Thousands are thought to have died during his time in office. Fernandez says since the family was ousted, a new version of that history has been shared across platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and even Wikipedia.
Saying, number one, that there were no human rights atrocities committed during the time of Marcos, that even if the economy was depressed, that it was basically the best period in Philippine history, that Marcos is a good president, even if there are contrary evidence.
Victor Dindo Manhid is a political analyst with the Manila-based think tank Strat-based ADR Institute. He says no one was ever really held accountable for the dictatorship era.
Now they have this freedom to question it. They have this freedom to revise it.
The world's request for comment from Bongbong Marcos's campaign on these criticisms was not answered. And it seems to be working, Manhid says, particularly with young people. Polling has consistently shown BBM with commanding popularity among young Filipinos.
The 18 to 44 years old. So these are people that was not born then. They are the focus of attention.
It's a population that doesn't know the Bongbong who was convicted of tax crimes and complicit with his father's atrocities. They really only know him as a politician who calls for unity and promises to continue his father's work to make the Philippines great, like building better infrastructure. And there's a good reason to target them. Young voters make up more than 50% of the electorate this time around, according to the Philippine Commission on Elections. 35-year-old Michelle Batista is one of them.
BBM is the best job.
I met her in a park in Marikina City, a part of Metro Manila. She works as a sales associate at a big box store. She says she likes that Bongbong is promising to lower the cost of electricity by focusing more on renewable energies like wind turbines. This was also an issue his father took on. Batista says she's spoken with many older people who are nostalgic for the Marcos era and say BBM's father was an excellent president. She believes that the posts on social media and advertisements on television that bash BBM are full of lies. It's not fair to compare him to his father. They were born in different generations, Batista says. BBM knows his history and he will not repeat the same mistakes again. Political experts note that surveys aren't always reliable and that the youth voting bloc is actually quite diverse. For many young voters in the Philippines, this will be their very first election, meaning they grew into voting age during President Rodrigo Duterte's tumultuous administration. The crass strongman has been very polarizing for the country. Bongbong is considered a Duterte ally and would continue some of the current president's policies, such as the deadly and unpopular war on drugs. So the youth vote may not be a slam dunk for Marcos just yet. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
Russia is the world's largest producer of fertilizer, but with a war in Ukraine and resulting sanctions, fertilizer supplies have dwindled and costs have skyrocketed. Farmers around the globe are scaling back production, which has led to concerns about hunger. Fertilizers made from ammonia and other chemicals made it possible to feed the world, although their runoff pollutes the environment. The current fertilizer shortage may lead to new interest in cleaner alternatives. In Bogota, Colombia, Manuel Rueda has a story of a Colombian entrepreneur who has turned to one unusual source.
At a small forest outside the Colombian town of Tunja, Germán Jesús points to trees that are more than 50 feet tall and bushes blooming with yellow flowers. He says that everything here was planted with fertilizer made from the poop of rhinoceros beetles. Jesús's company, Tierra Viva, has been making manure from insects for the past 15 years. This place used to be a grazing field for cows, Jesús says, as he walks around the small forest he's planted. In less than 7 years, we've reforested it with very tall trees and dense vegetation. Most fertilizer sold around the world is made by mixing nitrogen from the air with methane gas at high temperatures. So it's a process that creates carbon emissions. This kind of fertilizer also ends up in rivers and lakes when it rains, polluting the water. But several companies are now breeding insects to make organic manure that is cleaner but still helps plants and crops to grow. Their efforts could help to reduce pollution from agriculture in the future. Tierra Viva manure production starts every Friday when a truck loaded with discarded bits of vegetables and fruits arrives at the company's facilities. Workers using shovels compact the trash and organize it into big mounds. Then they pour a layer of sawdust on it and the solution that contains microorganisms. Finally, they place hundreds of beetle larvae on the mounds. The animals are about the size of shrimp.
Durante 4 meses, ellas van a estar alimentándose los residuos.
Jesús says that within 4 months, the larvae will eat up all of the trash below them and leave behind the big pile of their nutrient-rich poop.
En el año 2005, nosotros teníamos disponibles 36 toneladas.
When we started in 2005, we made about 35 tons of fertilizer, Jesús says. Now we make about 120 tons each year. Scientific studies suggest that insect fertilizer works. Luis Henault Etier is a Canadian biologist who has researched the properties of insect manure, or frass as it's known by scientists. She conducted an experiment where she grew vegetables with frass next to vegetables without any fertilizer and found the frass boosted productivity
by 16 times. So it's not like 16% more, it's like 16 times more. Now, why is that? Well, we're introducing nutrients.
A study carried out in Spain 2 years ago also suggests that plants that are grown with beetle manure are more resistant to pests. That's because insect excrements, which also include bits of their shells, contain a substance known as chitin.
The plant will detect the chitin and think, oh, I'm being under attack by a potential insect pest. So the plant is going to boost its immunity.
In spite of these benefits, many farmers continue to use chemical fertilizer because it provides better results in the short term. Still, many producers of insect manure are hoping that demand for their eco-friendly product increases as countries try to cut back on carbon emissions. In Colombia, Germán Jesús is showing some towns how to process their trash with his beetle larvae. Pedro Murillo is the mayor of Turmeque, population 7,000.
La primer ventaja.
The main reason we're trying this is to keep our environment clean and to keep mosquitoes away, he says. But it also generates fertilizer that we will be able to sell to local farmers. And while demand for insect fertilizer climbs, Jesús has also found another way to make money from his larvae. When they're fully grown rhinoceros beetles, about the size of a person's palm with curvy horns and shiny exoskeletons, he sells the animals to collectors in Japan and Europe. A pair of rhinoceros beetles can fetch up to $300. For the world, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogota.
Aside from that other thing that happened last night at the Oscars, there was also this warm moment for a movie and a city, Belfast. Here's screenwriter and actor Kenneth Branagh.
In the heartbreaking, heartwarming, human story of that amazing city of Belfast on the fabulous island of Ireland. This means a lot. Thank you so much. Thank you.
It's Kenneth Branagh's own story, as he explained to Stephen Colbert on The Late Show last November.
I'm from there. I was born in Belfast, and I lived there till I was nine. And the story of the film is really about something that happened to me when I was 9 years old and my family.
That something was the outbreak of the Troubles, the conflict in Northern Ireland that lasted about 30 years. One early flashpoint in Northern Ireland's crisis came in 1969. Branagh's own neighborhood was targeted by violence. At the time, Mount Collier Street was home to Protestants and Catholics living peacefully together. But extremists forced people everywhere to take sides. Belfast, the movie, shows the wrenching decisions Branagh's own family had to make about whether to stay in Belfast or leave.
Kids the same age as ours are getting killed or in the corner.
Well, be careful.
You can't be with them 24 hours a day. Can't take away their childhood either.
To stay or go is a main question at the heart of the movie Belfast. Sadly, a relevant question today for many people. It's also a reminder to hold on to home any way you can. That's why Kenneth Branagh told Stephen Colbert last year.
One of the things the film says, it's a lot of it is about leaving, and a lot of people understand it. I've been very moved by people from around the world. An Iranian filmmaker who came to see it came out and said, that's my story. A Nigerian came out and said, that's my story. But I think that what the story sort of suggests and hopes you can do is, you know, take your home with you. If your home is meaningful to you, and I think where we start is meaningful to us, even if we have to let it go or go back and live in it in a slightly different way, or sometimes maybe just carry it inside us. And of course, home isn't necessarily the bricks and mortar, although in this case it partly is, but it's family.
The story of many from Northern Ireland, also of Syrians and Salvadorans, and now Ukrainians and Russians and many more. Home, or as one Northern Irish singer, Ruby Murray, reminds us in one scene from Belfast, it's real love.
All I want from you is real love, the kind of love that grows and grows. La 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 la, you don't have to buy me flowers or pretty.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.